let's start in the last Torah. Zucher es asher osa lecho Amalek. Remember what Amalek did to you. So, it's one of the strange mitzvahs of the Torah. Remember what Amalek did to you, because I want you to blot out the memory. Yeah? The question is, of course, who would remember Amalek if we didn't keep on reminding ourselves? And what's the mitzvah? You know, the Ishbitz is always asking, what's the mitzvah today? What does it mean in modern terms? The Torah is nitzchi, the Torah is forever and infinite and eternal. Then every mitzvah, even if it seems like it's a mitzvah to do with the korbanot, sacrifices of the temple, which we no longer have, or mitzvahs hatuluyos baretz, mitzvahs that depend on living in the land of Israel, like trumas masa, bikurim, the Ishbitz always finds a way in which we can still keep those mitzvahs. What about zecher, timcha as zecher Amalek? This is a mitzvah, really, that we are told that we're going to do in the future, and it's going to be when God gives you menucha, when God gives you rest in the land that He's promised you, and then you put down your roots and you're safe, then you're going to have to go out and destroy Amalek. Zuchar is asher oselecha Amalek, remember what Amalek did to you, baderech, on the road when you came out of Egypt, and you were tired, and he caught up all the stragglers, those who were lagging behind. About to oyev, you were tired out. Velayore elikim, and he didn't fear God. So we learn in the Medrash, Ne'ema kan zucher, it says here, remember, v'ne'ema b'shabbos zucher, the Ten Commandments. The fourth commandment begins, zucher sima Shabbos likatshe, remember Shabbos to keep it holy. So why would we have a mitzvah that is such a negative commandment to destroy Amalek? Why would it begin with the same kind of word, the same, you know, opening, zucher, remember? Remember Shabbos to keep it holy. And you know, in Jewish law and in Jewish literature, we refer to the days of the week as Rishon b'Shabbos, Sheni b'Shabbos. We remember Shabbos every day of the week, and we make it part of our weekday. Where does Amalek come into that kind of remembering? So, the Medrash gives a moshel. Moshel misha omer zuchar ploini oy havai al tamchim leya kol tov. Zuchar ploini soinai al tamchim reikonis. You know, somebody comes into a kitchen and he sees there, you know, it's full of good things. It's ready for a feast. It's ready for Shabbos. It's got meat and fish and wine and stuff. You know, he says, you know, at this banquet, I'd like to remember my good friend who isn't with us today, but who's dear to my heart, and with all this abundance that I have here, I'd like to invoke my friend, my lover, whatever. And then, you know, you can have somebody who comes nebuch to a place which is like really, he walks into his house and it's starving, he opens the fridge and it's empty, he goes to the cupboards and there's nothing there, right? He says, you know, on a day like this, I'd like to remember my so-and-so. And the man who hurt me so much, my enemy, I'd like to remember and invoke him right here. Right? So we see that there's the zocher of Shabbos. You know, Shabbos is something we love. So we invoke it in the same way that, on just the opposite way around, sort of like a mirror image of Amalek. As much as we love Shabbos, we hate Amalek. So the Ishbitz says there's a deeper meaning. When the evil inclination has been torn out of the world, if God is in the future going to remove the evil inclination, then in the future, there isn't going to be any desire. There isn't going to be any longing. There isn't going to be any, like, cheshek to connect. You know, a lot of the things that we have in our life, they come from the innate desire that we have for either to acquire something, to join with something, or because of something inside us that wants, you know, thinking of the future, I'd like to have something, I'd like a comfortable house, I'd like to have money to settle down with. And so a lot of what motivates us is the desire for comfort, or the desire to procreate, right? I want friends, I want lovers, I want to have influence, or, you know, there's the desire to be liked, the desire for power. All these desires, if they are removed, as we think about the world to come, so then what desire is left? And this is frequently in Hasidus, in the Hasidic Sforim, there's this, it's a question, since so much of our cheshek, so much of our enthusiasm and joy and worshipping God springs not out of so much an appreciation of God, but as out of our longing. So much of our sense of worship isn't a sense of gratitude, but just a need to bow and to be seen and to be accepted. So what happens when the desire isn't there anymore? Even on the most basic level, now we live in a world where we have to deal all the time, every minute of the day, we have to deal with our desires. Whether it's a desire for a cup of coffee, or, you know, it's something that's triggered by somebody I see on the street, or something I read about, or, you know, I look on the side of a bus and I see something that, oh, I've got to buy that thing. So much of who we are all the time is being dictated to us by our desires. And a lot of the time, you know, who we are is a response to dealing with that, whether we deny our desires, whether we overcome our desires, whether we give in to our desires. L'chein, therefore, ka'ashi is gabe olav, when a person is in control of himself and his desires, then he ends up doing God's will with a tremendous sense of victory. And as we learn in the Zohar, our pasuk, Yikar mekoved mechachem sichlus ma'at. One of the interesting Ishbitz Torahs is that he says, you know, a little bit of silliness is more precious than pride and joy and wisdom. Mm-hmm. A person has to be in this world and allow themselves to be interested in what's going on, and not to take, you know, one of the differences between Judaism and other religions is that for us, it's very difficult to imagine having leaders, rabbis, who are not married, because, you know, if the person isn't in the world and he's not dealing, you know, with all the issues that arise out of being in a marriage, you know, whether those are issues of physical lust and things like that, and whether they're interacting and, you know, having to give and take and all the stuff that comes up, you know, if the rabbi is not dealing with it, then what do I need him for, right? So the Zohar Kodesh says that the idea of some things are more precious than wisdom. You know, it's all very nice to have a rabbi who's very wise and honorable, you know, but sometimes you need somebody who also doesn't win all his battles, right? And somebody who's sometimes a little bit foolish, because from that, you know, that person is then involved in the sichsuch of the Yetzer Hara. Somebody has to deal with the Yetzer Hara. Somebody who's dealing with the Yetzer Hara all the time is a very useful person to have around. So sometimes it's more precious than pure wisdom. because you know how the mishibut. But in the future, when we're going to be free of slavery, which means free of the yetzer hara, of the evil inclination, bascholi yele goydel nachet. To begin with, it's going to be great. Oh, no more slavery. Oh, we're free. We're not going to be constrained anymore by our desires. Ach, kasha yurgel ha'odim v'menucha. But once a person becomes used to it, once you become acclimated to living without being, without the compulsions and the constraint, liyagish tamkol kach benachet, then the ease doesn't taste so good anymore. It's nice. Freedom from the Yetzer Hara is going to be very nice for about an hour. And then, what are we going to have, right? We're going to be like, now what? Yeah. So then, that's what the Torah is telling us. I want you to remember. Because in your mind, you don't have to actually be in slavery to experience freedom from slavery. You can be in the memory. That we'll be able to remember what it felt like. We will not forget what it felt like to be in the grip of a compulsion that was really hurting. We will remember, we will be able to recall what it felt like to lose the battle with the Yetzer Hara. And from that, just the memory of that, will be enough to provide us with desire. And then we will both have the naicha, we will both have the menucha, the rest and the comfort of not having to chase the desire, and also we will still be able to recall the desire. It's interesting that this Ishbitz is very much like the 12-step programs of the Alcoholics Anonymous, right? That if somebody walks away from alcohol, it's not really good. It's better to keep going back to talk about with other people what it was like, what did it feel like to be in the compulsion. And then there's something about that recall that then makes the ease from alcohol constantly green. They say keep it green, because if it becomes old, then it's as though the substance or whatever, the thinking creeps back in the back. The back door of the mind, so to speak. So what they do is they meet, they talk about this is what it was like for me, and this is how I was caught up in this behavior, and this is how I used to be the day after. And there's the recall, right? And some people say, well, why are you mentioning it? If you want to walk away from it, why don't you just walk away from it? But there's something that happens as like a magic. That as soon as that happens, and the person, everybody in the room, even though everybody has a different story, but the feelings are the same. So they identify, and then there comes after that the neiche, the ease, the comfort that the Ishbitz talks about, which is a source of fresh cheshek and longing. With that pirish al tamche rekonis. And this is the meaning of on the empty. In the empty kitchen, to remember the enemy on the empty kitchen, because all the sins and all the pain and all the fighting and arguing that the Jewish people did, that's the real meaning of Amalek, right? Amalek is that source of friction inside us that causes us to do bad things. Because Amalek is called first among nations, meaning and that Amalek really plays the biggest part in our character. That God is at war with Amalek through all generations, because that part of us which is divine is always at war with that part of us which is Amalek. Kasha is battle. But what's going to happen when Amalek's koyach is taken away? When we recall how powerful it once was, then we will be able to renew our desire and our enthusiasm for those things that we want. So let's learn the previous Torah. So you got people, men, who are fighting. So the Torah says, you got two men who are fighting, and one, the wife of one of them, sees that her husband needs her help, right? So she grabs his opponent by his vulnerable parts, Vimavushov, which is normally understood to mean like his genitals. She grabs hold of them and so helps her husband in the fight. In other words, she fights really dirty, right? So the Torah says, V'katzoiso es kapo, and you cut off her hand, which means that she gets fined. Whenever the Torah says you cut off a hand, you cut off a leg, you cut, it's like, you know, we know that that never actually meant physically cutting off a hand. It always, there was a monetary value put on. So the monetary value would be the shame that the man experienced by, you know, having his privates attacked by this woman. So the Ishbitzer says, what does this mean to us? Kishe'odem yevayesh es chaveiro. You know, sometimes we're fighting with somebody and we get really defensive, you know, and then we think of what's the worst thing that I could say to hurt that person? What do I know about that person that making it public would really, really shame them? And that's the meaning of this pasuk. You've got two people who are fighting, and then the defensive, the weaker part of that person, which is the metaphor of the wife, right? She's the weaker half of the couple, right? She's that part, like, it's not, doesn't feel up to having a fair fight. So she fights dirty. So that part of me, which can't, you know, doesn't feel empowered, then says, ah, I know something that would, that I'll shut him up, you know? And I blurt out this thing of which that person's really ashamed. The word busha means shame. So it doesn't really mean vulnerable, but it does, because that's where we're vulnerable, right? Those things of which we're ashamed. So what does it mean? And you cut off her hand. The Gemara says that the right hand is a symbol. You know, and especially in this month, we have the scales, right? Is it Libra, right? And the two sides, the two pans, are called Kaf Yamin, the Kaf Smol. The right pan, or the right palm, and the left palm. Kaf Zchus, Kaf Choyva. The palm of guilty, and then the palm of innocent, right? So, you know, justice is always depicted as holding these scales, right? So there's a Kaf Yamin and a Kaf Smol. So when we talk about Kaf, the palm of the hand, which is the metaphor for the pan of the scales, right? The katsoiso is kapo. When we cut off her right hand, it means that we take away from her, we confiscate what is in her right hand, which are her merits. Because traditionally, merits go in the right-hand side of the scale, and demerits go in the left hand. So if we're cutting off her right hand, it means that we are removing her merits. And the Ishbitzer says that when you shame somebody, then they get all your mitzvahs and you get all the averot. They get all your virtues and you get all their vices. So, let's learn the previous Torah. Ki yikorei kam tzipor. One of the unusual mitzvahs in the Torah. If you're walking down the street and you see a bird's nest. So if you see the mother bird sitting on the eggs or sitting on the young hatchlings, then the mitzvah is to shoo away the mother bird and to make her fly away and to take the eggs or the young. And there's a special bracha. And the Torah tells us that there's a sechah for this mitzvah, that there's a reward for this mitzvah, which is a reward of long life. There are two mitzvahs in the Torah where we are promised long life, and this is one of them. The other one is kibud av v'em, honoring the father and mother. So the Torah says ki yikorei kam tzipor lefanecha, when you find the bird's nest, Shalach to Shalach Esraim, you should send away the mother, Vesabonim Tikachloch, and take the babies or the eggs, the fledglings, to yourself. So, this is one of the 613 mitzvahs. The Ishbitzi says it's a metaphor. Aim the mother, Hainug Haklolim Shel Divrei Torah. That refers to the klolim, the rules, the codes of the Torah. So, whenever we talk about the mother, we're talking about a larger set of principles. Ki haklolim shel divrei Torah hem shebechol dover tzorech ha'odam levaretz atzmoy al pikas nikudin lo'ires. Every person has to make sure that they are clean in respect of three things. Sheyivare shelayir b'dova anasishim shemetz neged Hashem Yisborach. A person has to make sure that there's nothing in what he does that is contrary to the will of God. The neged klal Yisrael, and a person has to make sure that the act that he does is not going to harm the Jewish people. V'gam le'odam oisa, and a person also has to make sure that the thing that he does is not going to harm himself. K'moshin izbar v'pashas kadoshim v'posikas shabsoi se tishmur. So every time a person acts, he needs to think globally, he needs to think locally, and he needs to think personally. Right. So, person needs to, you know, before I go out and make a declaration about something important, I need to make sure that I'm not going against God. I also need to make sure I'm not jeopardizing the Jewish people. And also equally important, I need to make sure what I'm doing is not going to harm myself. ועל פי הכלולים צריך האדם לסנג בכל עניין. And by these rules, a person has to lead the whole life. Everything that you do, you have to make sure it's not going to harm yourself, but also not going to harm other people, and also not going against God. והנה, הכלולים האלה יחייבו שאין אדם מחויב למסנה שהיא על מצווה קלה. The result of this rule, which is like the mother rule, right? The result, the consequence is that you don't have to jeopardize yourself for any small thing, right? I mean, there are big issues, you know, you have to make a stand, of course. There are things like, you know, not to kill somebody else, or, you know, not to go worshipping idols or whatever it is, but small things, you don't endanger your life, right? וזה רואים as שלח to שלח אין. So now the Ishbitzi says, yes, but sometimes the Torah tells us, send away the mother. That there are moments in everybody's life when you have to ignore the big rule. You have to ignore all the rules. היינו שישלח את הכלולים, you have to throw away these rules, שלא ישגיח עליהם, not to look at them, רק ימסה נשי, but in fact, to be ready to die, for the purpose of even the smallest, slightest mitzvah. Kama Shemitzina but Daniel, like we find with Daniel. You know, why was Daniel thrown into the lion's den? Everybody knows that he was thrown into the lion's den, right? Why was he thrown into the lion's den? So, if you look at the verse in Daniel, it says, you know, Daniel was very influential at the court of the king of Babylon, and he had enemies. So they said to the king, you know what, your majesty, you are a god. You are the most powerful man in the world. You are, the king of Babylon, right? You didn't get much taller or higher on the totem pole than king of Babylon, right? So they said, look, make a law for the next 30 days. Nobody's allowed to pray to their god. If they have a request, they bring it to you. So they passed the law, and of course, the next afternoon, Daniel is called praying to God. And so he was thrown into the lion's den, and we know that the lions didn't eat him, and then the king was very impressed, and he lived happily ever after. Why did Daniel jeopardize his life for the sake of davening mincha? Mincha is not something that you have to die for. But what was it? There was a reason, right? Shemos Nashal Tfila, he was ready to give his life just for that davening. Mordechai, and we find in the Megillah of Esther, right, on Purim, Shemos Nashal Shleili Shtachvois Lahoman, he was not going to bow down to Haman. And you know something? Mordechai jeopardized the whole Jewish people. Mordechai, when he didn't bow down to Haman, we were really mad at him. We were saying, Mordechai, why don't you just go home? Why are you sitting here on the street antagonizing Haman, who you know is an anti-Semite? Can't you be frum in your own house? Who's asking you to come physically sit out here on the street where you know he's going to walk past so that you can be very orthodox and not bow down to him? And what would be if you bow down? What will be so the Jewish people won't be annihilated? That would be such a terrible thing. The Rabbi Akiva Shemosinashi Altintilas Yudaim, and Rabbi Akiva, who had only one glass of water per day, and he used that water to wash his hands, because he said you can't do anything holy, you can't get up in the morning not wash your hands, right? That's not what the Torah is asking. Not from Daniel. That's not what the Torah is asking from Mordechai. That's not what the Torah is asking from Rabbi Akiva. You know, I think that this Ishbitz has also chosen these three because these three represent these three Nekudin Le'oraisa. Because Daniel, by dying for the right to daven mincha, he was going against God. God did not demand a person die for mincha, right? And if Daniel had died, what would people say? What would people say about God? Oh, that a man was so afraid of God, you know, look at the Jewish God, that he's so terrifying that Daniel was too scared to miss a mincha, you know, because God would pass. So that was really, Daniel's not davening was really damaging to God's reputation. I mean, he had this whole story, right? And Mordechai, he was endangering the Jewish people. And Rabbi Akiva was endangering himself. So what gave them the right to do this? And not just the right, but what is it that happened to them that made them feel that this was really the only thing for them to do? So the Ishbitz says, Ki hevinu, they understood, Shehamitzvah hazois hi shayeches lehem b'shorishah. Mordechai knew that not bowing down to Haman is a mitzvah that is connected with his soul at the deepest level. Because every human being has their own mitzvah, their own special mitzvah, bifrat, which is unique in its details to that person. Commission is Baal B'Kamim Mikoyim, says we've explained many, many times. And this is the meaning of throw away, send away the mother and take the children for yourself. The word bonim is like the word bina, which means understanding. Sometimes you have to understand deeper than the rule, and you have to go for the detail. You have to leave the klal and take the prat. And now we can understand why the Talmud says, Kikore, if you have a dove that lives in your back garden and makes a nest, there's no mitzvah of shiluach hakan. If you have one, you know, sometimes a bird builds a nest on your windowsill, right? You look out there, you see, there's no mitzvah of shiluach hakan. It's only if you're walking on the street, minding your own business, and you come across a nest, then there's a mitzvah of shiluach hakan. Because it says, ki kore, if it happens that you find a nest, not that you prepared a nest, that you build a whole bunch of you know, birds' houses so that you should be able to do this mitzvah, then it's not a mitzvah. That's not the mitzvah. Because if you take it as the story of Daniel and the story of Mordechai and the story of Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Akiva didn't go to prison so that he should be put himself in such a position that he should be ready to die for washing his hands. Right? It happens. Sometimes we find ourselves in life, you know, that we're in a situation that calls on us to break that one moral law that we have built for ourselves our whole life on. You know, there are some things that a person thinks to himself, you know, this is like this act of compassion, or this act of selflessness, or this act of kindness, or this mitzvah of davening, or this Pesach or Yom Kippur, this is my day when I really connect with my soul. Then, if something happens to jeopardize that, then you say, no, I'm putting my foot down, I don't care what it costs me, even if it costs me my life, I'm not bending on this issue. But nobody would put themselves in a position, go looking for a way in which they could endanger themselves this way. It's only kishiyun el yodoy. When it happens by accident, then the Torah says, shalach to shalach esu'im, send away the mother, and grab hold of that detail and hang on to it. And the Gemara, there's a Gemara that talks about somebody who says, he was davening, and he said, Master of the Universe, your mercy goes even onto the birds, you know, because sending away the mother when you take the child is like an act of mercy. And the Gemara said, what are you talking about? Like, what do you know from mercy? What do you, I mean, you know what God's mercy is. You're like projecting. You're projecting. Because, you know, this is not about mercy, this is an accident happened, right? This is not something that we want to do in order to prove something. This is something that happens to us that is testing us, right? So there's a big difference. And you know, sometimes when you look at history and you see the story of great people, it's rarely because they saw the greatness in themselves and they decided to test it in the fires of history. Those kind of people who see greatness in themselves and then they decide to test it against, you know, where the rubber hits the road and see what sparks they can raise by going against the powers that be. They're usually very tragic stories, right? Very tragic stories. The stories of the people that we admire are people who did not set out to antagonize anybody, and they didn't set out to be, to show, to prove anything. They were minding their own business, and history called upon them. And they, at some point in the story, in the event as they unfolded, they came across some principle that they wouldn't give. And history pushed, and they pushed back, you know, and they became like so rigid that they became like something you could bend an iron bar around. There was something in the core of these people that just wouldn't bend, and that's the greatness that we're talking about here. And moments like that, you don't have to answer to anybody in this world or in the other world. Moments like that, which always happen by accident, they're never premeditated. Moments like that, they are divine moments. They're historic moments. All right, so let's start at the beginning of the Seder. When you go out to war against your enemies, and you take captive his captives. Right, so ostensibly the Torah is telling us that we are going to have to go to war with our enemies. We're not talking about the wars of conquering the land where we didn't take any prisoners. But let's say at some point in the future there's a necessity for a war, and then the people that we conquer become our slaves. And we see among the among the captives a beautiful woman, and so on and so on. This is the law of the beautiful woman. Yefas toya. So the Ishbitzer says, why does it say, when you go out to war on your enemies, and you take captives, its captives. Why does it just say, and you take captives? Vishavisa Shevi, and you take a captive. Why does it say Shivyoi, its captives? Because the assumption is that the nation that you are conquering has already conquered other nations and has taken captives from other places. So it's basically, you know, people are being recycled. There's a metaphor involved. The Ishbitzer says, when we're at war with that part of ourselves which is, you know, trying to conquer us, and we're fighting back, there are aspects of personality that are captive to the dark side. And when we win the war, then we are not just taking control of the dark side, but we are also releasing the captives that are there, captive in the dark side. Hadova hatoiv hanimtze behu'um. You know, when we go to war with the nation that is next door to us and we take its captives, we are also going to be taking the captives that the nation took captive from another place, which is to say, the good thing that is in the bad nation. I may have an enemy, I may have to kill that enemy, right? But there may be good things that that enemy has acquired. Because in all the and the nations, there's good things. They're not pure bad. Even the worst enemy that I have is not purely bad. So long as the good thing or the beautiful thing is there in that nation, it's captive. But when it comes, when we integrate it and we assimilate it into the Jewish experience, then that thing which may have been a negative thing when it was there becomes a positive thing. It's hard to give an example because you know, our history is now so mingled and tied in with the history of the world. It's hard to say. It's hard to say. This is an example of how the Jewish people have, you know, if you look at the history of, if you look at the history of labor in the 20th century, most of the labor movements were led, organized, by Jewish people, particularly here in America, you know, the trades unions, the fair trade practices, the laws against child labor, and the number of hours a person could be made to work, and minimum wages, health care, standards of safety in factories, and things like that. Jews, in the first half, the first third of this century, here in America, we're really responsible for all that activism and the shape of the United States and the modern industrial landscape is really a remnant of those active years and everybody was involved, and from Justice Brandeis all the way down to the women who died in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire on Erev Shabbos. You know, if you look at what we did with activism, and then you compare it with what happened in the Soviet Union, you know, with the same ideas, you know, the nobility of labor and the value and the fight against savage capitalism and if you look and you see what we as Jewish people did with those ideas compared You know, even if you go into Israel, early Israel, and you have a look at the collectives, right, the kibbutzim, and you know, in the 1980s and 1990s, and these times, you know, some of those kibbutzim that were set up at the beginning of the 20th century, they sort of sold out, right? And when they sold out, then the people who were living there became millionaires, you know, because they had acquired over 80 years or whatever, they'd acquired this enormous wealth, they'd been working all those years. And when they decided to disband this communist lifestyle because it was no longer fashionable, they were worth millions. But, you know, when the Soviet Union packed in the 1980s or 90s, whenever it was, and everybody, they sold everything, right? Gorbachev and they sold everything, and then they gave everybody like what they'd been working for 80 years, and it was enough to buy a pair of shoes, I think. So the Ishbitz says, you know, we have this genius that when we go and we conquer, right, and then we absorb, we release the captives that are there, and then we take them to us, then there's something magical that comes out of that, and that's a beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful process, and it's the beautiful woman, right? The choshaktaba. You take her, and then you bring her into your home, and you integrate her. And there's a process. And then this is another level. The Ishbitz says, you know, what is it that what is this magical quality that is there in the goyim, in the nations, you know, that we are so fascinated by, that we find so attractive? And you know what it is? It's their desire. Because what they do with it, the way they concretize it, the way they goyim take the desire and turn it into a physical thing, that's usually a mess, and it never lasts. But there's something magical in the quality itself that we become attracted to. And this is the teshuka, this is the desire. And this comes down to the basic Ishbitz idea that desire is the manifestation of God in the individual and God in the society. And that each ummah, each nation has its oifi, has its genius. And that genius is represented by the desire of the people. You know, some people have this tremendous desire for order. Ordnung, the way I think of the German people. And there's something magical in that desire. You know, and it expressed itself in many different things over the centuries, and none of them were very nice. But the desire was a beautiful desire. It's a musical thing. And there's great music that's available that comes out of that order. But also, you know, there are the death factories that also come out of it. So the Ishbitz says, more often than not, the nation, when it acts out on its desires, will produce nothing good. But the fact that they have inside them that longing for something, and that they experience that as a need to develop, that is a beautiful thing. We don't need to go to the Germans to get their compulsive orderliness. That's not what we want from them. We want from them the feeling of something missing. See, the closest that we can get to God is that feeling of something missing. What? Missing what? Yeah, everybody's experiences that in a different way. You know, sometimes we use the phrase the God-shaped hole. If when you're experiencing longing, if you can feel it where it's supposed to be felt, which is in the stomach. Desire is experienced in the stomach as a feeling of emptiness, as a space. I once heard from somebody, and it immediately stuck in my mind, this phrase, the God-shaped hole, right? Because it's a deep, empty feeling, which I'm trained to try and fill it with food, with drugs, with alcohol, with tobacco, with whatever it is, right? Whatever activity, with gambling, with What am I trying to do? What am I trying to fill with that activity or with that chemical? It's that feeling. But that feeling, the God-shaped hole is an accurate description because each of us experiences it in a different way, and it can be experienced in a national way, as a national God-shaped hole. And that God-shaped hole in the nation will drive the nation towards its destiny, right? And very often nations get caught up in this destiny jack, right? And really, it's not it at all. The idea, the picture that they have of their destiny is a very crude, you know, acting out, and they get fixated. We see it all the time, even today. And really, it's an invitation to look at the experience of God missing from the inside. And so long as this longing is there among them, then it is mishivya, it's captive. Because the power of desire, einoi rak mehashem yisbarach, that only comes from God. Ve'ze'ein shayach lehem, it doesn't belong to them. Rak liyisrael. This is what God wants us to find in our journeys among the nations. So the Torah tells us, so you go out to war with your enemies, and you see among her captives, you see this beautiful woman, and you desire her. And you take her for a wife, and you bring her into your house, and she cuts her hair, and she removes the garments of her captivity from on her. And in ancient times, one of the ways that women had of protecting themselves in times of war was when the enemy was breaking through the defenses, the women would dress up really nicely, you know, and then there would be prizes, and that was their way of protecting themselves. So if you see this woman and she's very beautiful to you, well, you got to take her home and put her in ordinary clothes, you know, and then see if you still find her beautiful. So the Ishbitzer says, Bamus, the truth is, the deepest truth is, if the Jewish people find something beautiful, it's beautiful. Don't have to find fault with it, you know? If the Jewish people have cheshek, are drawn towards a certain characteristic behavior, to a certain national identity, whatever it is, you know, when the Jewish people are drawn towards something, it's because there's something beautiful in it, not because it is a seductive thing. The Jewish people as a whole are not seduced by things unless there's something real there. Because as much as we are romantic, we're also cynical. And so, when on a deep level I am drawn to something and I find something very attractive, I don't have to suspect it's because there's something perverse in me. Or there's something unhealthy in me. And like, why are you looking at that goyish thing? Why is that Gentile thing, that pagan thing, why does it look so attractive to you? If you were really a Jew, then you would be satisfied with what's Jewish and you wouldn't be looking out there into the pagan and seeing something attractive. Foy, don't look at it. It's tame, it's unclean for your eyes, and don't be drawn to it. You know, I can hear those voices, I can hear those tapes. And for a lot of Jewish people, that's the attitude that is encouraged. And when children come and say, you know, oh, I'm interested in that, it's like, no, don't look there, that's goyish. And the Ishbitzer says, it's a really sad way to think. If a Jew finds something attractive in the goyish world, it's because there's something there. Not necessarily the thing itself, but what made this thing happen? What made this thing happen? You know, I used to live in Brooklyn, and I would travel sometimes at night on the BQE, Brooklyn Queens Expressway, and I would look out across the water and see downtown Wall Street and the Battery Park, and then, of course, in those days, there was the Twin Towers. And I would just stop and look, you know. And one hand, I'd say to myself, what is this? Ah, it represents capitalism at its finest, right? This is one person trying to make more money than another person. And you know, this is, this represents, you know, the blatant, you know, whatever you can, all the slogans you can think of, you know, are the bad things in the world, you know, the destruction of the natural environment and the misuse of the and the pollution of the that and exploitation of this, you know. And then I'd look at it with another eye and I'd say, you know, how many people worked together to make those buildings go up? And how many people work together to keep them clean? And how many people work to keep them lit and heated? Those lights there, that street, that area of Wall Street represents the achdus, the unity, the peaceful coexistence and cooperation of millions of people who, if they had their druthers, would just be bonking each other over the head with clubs and dragging each other off half dead to their caves, right? But we don't do that. We get together and we do things together. And, you know, really long-term projects. And thousands, millions of people worked long-term without seeing the thing in front of them as part of a plan to make something lasting, to make something great, to make something solid. When I look at downtown Manhattan, you know, I that's the feeling that I see there. This is what the Ishbitz is talking about. The downtown Manhattan may in fact be a pollution, and it may in fact be an abomination, and it may in fact be an environmental disaster, and all the things, the bad things you want to say. True. The cheshik, the desire that made this thing, you know, it's like, so what? But what is it in the humans that makes them want such a thing? Where's that dream of glory? What is at the basis of it? What is it that those people who build those buildings, what is it that they lack? What is that experience inside them of, you know what it is? It's God inside them. Experienced as a void, as a need. Experienced as a desire. And the Ishbitz says, that, you gotta have that. You gotta get that. That is Beshevi, it's in captivity until you have it too. So, what do? We take the thing. Tzorech lebirurin. So we take this beautiful woman and we tell her, no, take off those beautiful clothes, put on an apron, you know, let me see you do the dishes, and let's see if you still look beautiful, right? Im ola ez chen gvan beinov, v'loy chen amiti. Was it some superficial thing that found favor in my eyes, or was it something real? L'chein tzeva shetosi meos ha'gvanim. So the Torah says, so all right, bring her into your house, and force her to live as a plain person. And then afterwards, if she still looks beautiful, then it's for sure certain positive that the person wasn't fooled, and that in fact the good thing is there inside that person, inside that thing. And then the reason that it has come to you and you have stumbled over it and fallen in love with it is because it's connected to you, your Shoresh Neshama, and that your future, your development as a spiritual creature is dependent on absorbing the desire, this new desire, and see where it takes you.